While you're getting your seat, let me thank Herb again for a wonderful presentation, and just add that if you're interested in some of the publications and videos of Apple Shop, you can visit the website at appleshop.org. It's appalshop, not Apple as in an apple a day, okay? So just to help you out a little bit with that. All right. Our next speaker is Dr. Bob Hutton. His topic is Political Violence in the South and America. Dr. Hutton is a lecturer in History Department at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. He received his Ph.D. in History from Vanderbilt University and his B.S. and M.A. in History, both from Appalachian State University. Dr. Hutton is the author of Bloody Bread, Politics and Violence in the Appalachian South, which is forthcoming in 2013, and he's working on another very interesting project on William Goebel and populism. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Hutton.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Can everybody hear me? Okay. I appreciate everyone who recommended me to the folks at the Filson. I was told that more than one person mentioned me, and I'm very proud to hear that. Especially Dr. Waller, who y'all saw yesterday evening. Her work in the 1980s and 1990s is what originally led me down this path. One thing I'll mention before I start out, just so you know, Appalachia exists in space, and we've talked a lot about the space of Appalachia as a place. It also exists in time, and time, at least on the human scale, is very much limited. So anything I have to say today pretty much just pertains to a specific frame of time. And if you ask me anything about anything that happened after World War I, I'm the wrong person to ask. My head's pretty much around 1900 to 1910, if not earlier. And that's pretty much what I'm going to be speaking about today. There's an element to Appalachia that often gets overlooked because it's an element to American society in general, and that is our politics, our two-party system, the way we allocate and reallocate power, the way we change our government once every couple years, once every 2 years, once every 4 years, or on the state level or on the county level. This is something that's pretty much universal to the American Republic. So today I'm not going to be talking about what makes Appalachia different, what makes Appalachia peculiar. What I found while studying Breathitt County in the second half of the 1800s was a lot of what makes at least this one part of eastern Kentucky very much part of the American whole. So bear in mind that's what I'm going to be talking about today. Now, that is, of course, overlapping with this whole feud thing. And to me, I'll say right up front, feud is simply a word. And it's a word that's been applied to any number of different instances. So I'll start from there. I'm tickled about the public interest that the feud scenario is getting, mainly because my book's coming out. That's the main reason I'm tickled. And y'all have heard of two for the price of one. Well, University of Kentucky Press has mine, one for the price of two. But you can buy it anyway. It is available starting next month on Amazon. I think they moved me from July 6th to July 16th, but be looking for that. But I'm also apprehensive, mainly because I'm concerned that the same sort of misinformation about eastern Kentucky that circulated all through the 20th century is going to reemerge and become more solidified than ever. Worse yet, I'm concerned that we'll continue to look at the Mountain South, not just eastern Kentucky, not just this idea we call Appalachia, but what I prefer to call the Mountain South, some sort of piece of land all to itself with no significance beyond itself. I wrote about violence in eastern Kentucky not so much for the sake of Kentucky history, Appalachian history, or Southern history. I think there's something we can learn about violence as a global phenomenon right here at home. This is especially true regarding the way Americans talk about violence in far-off places. Some of the most violent places on earth, or at least the most publicized violent places on earth, are as allegedly isolated from the so-called outside world as Eastern Kentucky supposedly was a century ago. And we find time and time again that the forces of history that produce violence are hardly ever unconnected to what goes on in the big cities, the realms of the powerful. They are often the so-called tribal areas of places like Central Asia or Sub-Saharan Africa, places contained by a nation state like our own, but beyond that nation state's supposed direct authority, supposedly. These claims are often specious, but they are a way for politicians and journalists to formulate easy answers to difficult questions. And they are not too different in how the press and other powerful men discussed Eastern Kentucky starting, I think, in the 1870s, really. This, I believe, is no coincidence. Worst of all, I'm also concerned about the very use of the word feud, like I mentioned, a word that I believe obscures and denies the meaning behind violence. The word has countless meanings going back to Shakespeare, actually earlier than Shakespeare, but I like Shakespeare, and suggests something foreign to the modern American experience. Don't forget that our ancestors around 1890 or so considered themselves quite modern, and they needed a non-modern to contrast themselves to. But let me lay out a little the first little bit of Shakespeare's description of the Montagues and the Capulets. This will be familiar to a lot of y'all. Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene, from ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. So what do we have here? Two equal parties on a perfectly equal standing, fighting over something no one remembers, so that this continued enmity disrupts modern life and seems like some strange vestige from the past, even though it's happening in the present. Between the Civil War and World War I, mass violence in North America was common all over, if you think about it. And it falls into three broad categories, really. You got the Indian Wars, anything from the Little Bighorn to Wounded Knee, and so many in between that are going on across the Mississippi River. You have the labor disputes, everything from the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 on up to Pullman, on up to you name it, especially in the Midwest, but also right here in Kentucky, of course. And, of course, the crimes against black citizenship in the South, and this at a time, of course, when 90% of African Americans lived in the former Confederacy or the former slave states. In Kentucky or elsewhere, feud suggested a conflict set apart from these three categories. It suggested a fight carried out for relatively low stakes, bereft of any economic, racial, or nationalistic significance. Since the word has associations with a European or a British past, calling something a feud places it in the past, essentially discouraging readers from wondering too much if it might have somehow be part of larger current forces. Violent occurrences often become feuds only when they are labeled as such. Only when someone like our friend Henry Watterson decides to use that four-letter word. And this could include any number of knife fights or riots or anything in between. And it depends on where Watterson or whoever happens to be writing about what year between, let's say, 1875 and 1905. Any number of different kinds of violence are referred to as feuds, even when they're not necessarily reciprocal between two equal parties. The so-called feuds of Eastern Kentucky that we see on the historical record were very often related to current conditions, as Dr. Waller made clear last night. Whether in the rest of Kentucky, whether conditions in Frankfort or Louisville, or sometimes beyond, elsewhere in the United States, or I contend, in some cases, if we look at global occurrences around the turn of the century, we can see them reflected in Eastern Kentucky. What have often been called the so-called mountain feuds were not common throughout the Appalachian region, except in storybooks. In fact, they were almost, A, perfectly contained within the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and B, with very few exceptions, typically contained within county boundaries and fought over control of said counties. The Hatfield-McCoy feud, being one very notable exception. This is, if nothing else, suggests that these were something. There was something at work other than just the allegedly natural traits of the so-called Mountain Whites. Moreover, with few exceptions, most of the so-called feuds were centered around a distinct area of eastern Kentucky and over the course of a relatively short span of time. Think about it. We're mainly talking about a handful of occurrences, mostly in the 1880s, at least three of the bigger ones in the last 3 years of the 1880s. You're looking at Perry County, Harlan County, Breathitt County, contiguous to each other. It suggests that there's something else at work, some sort of civil disorder that whoever, be it Governor Buckner or perhaps Henry Watterson or whoever it happened to be telling the story, simply used the word feud to describe this. And for that matter, look to the parts of eastern Kentucky where there was no mass violence. What about the corners of the mountains or the corners of other parts of Kentucky in the western or the eastern bluegrass that are supposedly Appalachian, whatever that means, where this never happened? If this was supposedly ubiquitous throughout the mountains, then why does it only happen in certain places? For that matter, look to parts of the country outside of Kentucky that share these same traits that one associates with vendetta violence. For instance, if this was a symptom of Scots-Irish ancestry, as it's popular to say, then western Pennsylvania should have been the most violent place in the U.S. from the 1700s right up until Jimmy Stewart was born. And we certainly don't think of Jimmy Stewart as a particularly violent fellow, except in Winchester 73. That's the one exception. He kicks some butt in that movie. But for the most part, though, here we have a very typical Scots-Irish American Presbyterian who doesn't fit this image at all. So I'm not a big fan of that particular theory, as you can probably tell. In any case, this sort of language of inherency is a historian's worst enemy. Historians prefer change. We like to think about names and dates because they help us look at the way society changes as opposed to the way society stays the same. Most serious previous inquiries into this subject came to a general consensus, and a lot of the people who came to this consensus are in this room. There have been distortions and misunderstandings about eastern Kentucky, Appalachia, and a fair chunk of the white southern population. And making these points has been the chief task of most historians of Appalachia since the 1970s, if not earlier. And of course, Herb mentioned, it goes all the way back to Cratus Williams, who was sort of the godfather of our subfield. The task of debunking deceptive images and challenging the modernist positivist assumptions about progress and backwardness take up most of our time. If nothing else, Appalachian history stands as a serious challenge to the American assumptions about the linear process of economic and democratic ascension. However, that should not make Appalachia a counterculture to the rest of the country. This was and is a region populated by American citizens who saw themselves as little different than other American citizens. We could carry on for hours about dialects or cuisine, but when it came to political participation, mountain men were as much a part of the American mainstream as anyone else. And I do say men because I'm discussing a time period before the 19th Amendment, so bear that in mind. They felt this way because they were active, fervent participants in the American political process from the moment of first white settlement until the present. The same newspapers that called mountaineers primitive also printed their poll results a few months later after elections without ever publicly contemplating this weird cognitive discrepancy. If they're just primitives, then why are we counting their votes in the box scores in the Louisville Courier Journal? Like all citizens of the American Republic, residents of eastern Kentucky were political actors. First, I think I should address what it is means when I say political. There are more than one kinds of politics. There's more than one way to use that word. Most Americans think of our two-party system, but there's also a broader meaning, one that Americans recognized as reality in the second half of the 1800s. Politics, in its most inclusive meaning, deals with allocation of power in a given setting, not just necessarily among fellow citizens, but between human beings who are forced to share physical space. And that's why I consider the Indian Wars definitely a political dispute. Most struggles over power are relatively one-sided. unlike a supposed theoretical feud. Political violence is, by and large, a series of narratives about the strong preying upon the weak, or in recent centuries, the weak attempting to settle the score. When people kill, they usually do so for reasons they consider of utmost importance, the defense of a race or a nation state, or a status quo. This is a couple of narratives that pretty much defines Western politics, at least since the American or French Revolution. Feud, on the other hand, suggests a lateral conflict between equals, one in which power is never forcibly exchanged. Although adversaries may believe an end may come, it never does, and it lends the conflict with an air of futility. This, of course, comes to an end when two teenagers commit suicide, as we see happening in Fair Verona at the end of the play. It takes a tragedy like that for it to actually come to an end. Futility is the key to the observer or to the reader. It means a lack of seriousness, low stakes, and stakes that are never won by any party. We've had many cartoons done about the Hatfields and McCoys, but there will never be a cartoon done about the massacre at Wounded Knee. We gain our understanding of politics from the city-states of ancient Greece, and we may know from their history that killing is potentially as much a political act as is voting. Coincidentally or not, we also get our earliest conceptions of kinship-based blood feuds from the Greeks as well. And so it shouldn't surprise us too much that our ancestors in the late 1800s were, as y'all probably know, obsessed with the history of the ancient world because they saw these parallels. So what brought all this about? We cannot really interrogate American violence in this time period. Again, the last three or four decades of the 1800s, without at least paying some homage to the Civil War. It's the progenitor of killing, the standard bearer of death for at least two generations of Americans, arguably three. Any discussion of violence in the South should at least mention the precedent of carnage set by the war. White Northerners and Southerners shed blood to either defend or eradicate an economy based around slavery. Former slaves becoming soldiers and shed blood in order to end slavery and by extension begin the process of black citizenship. How was this different in Kentucky? Well, as y'all know, no state except perhaps Missouri had a higher rate of guerrilla activity fighting on both sides than did Kentucky. No other unseceded state contributed so many troops to the Confederate Army, as y'all probably know. No state except for Louisiana produced as many volunteers for the U.S. colored troops. This was a drastically divided state, and especially after the summer of 1863, most of Kentucky's war experience was constituted of fighting between people who knew each other. Like in most civil wars of the last 400 years, Kentucky's Civil War blurred the distinction between civilian and soldier, which is a very common thing. Civilians were not only victims of military abuses, but among the ostensibly defensive home guards. We talked about them a bit last night, right? They were sometimes supposed to protect different communities from invasion and often became aggressors. So in the meantime, after 1865, both ordered violence and disorderly violence outlasted the war. And while it was not always obviously tied to the war between the states, there's a whole panoply of different types of violence that last until centuries in that I believe can be traced back to the war, either directly or indirectly. And of course, there's a number of historians who are starting to say that perhaps we should think of the Civil War as maybe lasting past Appomattox, that maybe Appomattox is simply one of the piece, one part of the piece. McKnight, Dr. McKnight over at University of Virginia at Wise, wrote a great book on the war on the Virginia-Kentucky line, and he found significant evidence that suggested that fighting continued more or less unabated at least until 1866. And the eastern third of the entire state of Kentucky may prove to be the setting for a civil war lasting far longer than is traditionally thought. And the more we look into it, the more evidence we may find of that. Kentucky's two-party system was defined by the war for decades after as well, at least until 1900. What we see in eastern Kentucky during the Gilded Age was almost always brought based upon the American two-party system. Republicans shot at Democrats and vice versa. It was a breakdown of the political process, But at the same time, it was a destruction that still conformed to the dictates of the functioning body. In other words, as similar as these two parties were and continue to be, their differences often ended up with smoke from the barrel of a gun. It's been said that for three generations after the Civil War, Americans almost always voted in the direction that they had shot. And if you look at the electoral record, up until around the election of Woodrow Wilson, that tends to be the case. And, of course, that's around the time that a lot of war veterans are dying. In eastern Kentucky, men who had shot in both directions found themselves elbow to elbow. And a crisis of legitimacy was almost inevitable, especially since the federal government did nothing to pacify the region while it struggled to bring peace to places like Louisiana, South Carolina, and other parts of the South. Kentucky had never officially rebelled, not officially, and so was not subject to either presidential or congressional reconstruction. There have been a handful of books written about Kentucky during Reconstruction, but we should always remember that Kentucky was never reconstructed. So the first so-called feud of the postbellum period is one that Jerry Deaton mentioned just yesterday, the so-called Strong-Amos feud. Demonstrates the connection between eastern Kentucky and the larger South during the years of Reconstruction. I've found a bit of evidence from 1868 and 1869 that suggests that the original departure between William Strong and Wiley Amos, who were comrades in the Union Army, and I have found data that suggests they truly were members of the 14th Cavalry, I found evidence that suggests that their original rupture was based around the issues of the day. The issues, of course, being the 14th Amendment and the prospect of African-American citizenship, even in a place that was almost overwhelmingly white, of course, Breathitt County, Kentucky. In the 3 years after the war, Wiley Amos came to realize the true meaning of his past war effort. It was clear the Union victory meant black citizenship, and it was a prospect he could not abide. Strong, however, was considered a protector and ally of the small number of former slaves in Breathitt County. One book called him the special protector of the colored race. And he was deemed, for that reason, a so-called radical Republican, or at least the closest approximation of such in that neighborhood. Amos threatened Strong over this issue during the 1868 elections. And within months, they and other male members of their families and other allies were exchanging gunfire. This series of fights, it should be noted, coincided with the first recorded appearance in eastern Kentucky of a group calling itself the Ku Klux Klan. The first time we read in the Louisville commercial of a group referring to itself as that. And notice how loosely I'm using that, because different groups use this name. It's no later than the summer of 1870, no earlier than the summer of 1870, that we know there were groups somewhere around Breathitt County, Owsley County, Lee County, that were calling themselves this. And I don't think this is a coincidence. Strong, of course, came out on top on this so-called feud. Amos apparently moved west to Missouri or Kansas around 1870 or 1871. In fact, this was the only thing that set this conflict apart from dozens of other conflicts going on all over Kentucky in 1868. The apparent winner was on the side of black citizenship. Typically, that was not the case in Kentucky. Strong was seen in the company of an interracial armed gang multiple times over the next decade in a clear demonstration that he would not tolerate the neo-Confederate control over his county and Kentucky as a whole that the war had failed to prevent. You'll notice that Kentucky elects a lot of Confederate veterans as governor in the 1870s, 1880s, and I think maybe even as late as, of course, Simon Buckner. No, as late as McCreary, when he came back the second time around in the early 20th century, Kentucky had one of the last governors who was a Confederate veteran. So it's been said that Kentucky seceded in 1865 rather than 1861. And Bill Strong was not having any of it. Of course, he believed his fight should be limited to his immediate community. And as Mr. Deaton pointed out yesterday, he did this brutally. In appearances in 1874, 1878, a number of other times, including when two of his henchmen, one white and one black, were lynched in front of the courthouse in Jackson in 1884. It was in the middle of Kentucky's relatively early rash of lynchings. and during this time in which lynching was becoming a phenomenon throughout the South. This was not the last violent incident in Breathitt County's history, and in fact, the most famous ones took place after William Strong himself was ambushed and murdered in 1897. And of course, that's its own story. However, each of them could be traced somehow to events going on elsewhere in Frankfort, Louisville, or other hinterland areas of Kentucky. What astonishes us most in the 21st century was that this was allowed to happen. It shouldn't astound us at all. Countless acts of bloodshed went unprevented and unpunished by either the state or the federal governments all over America during this time. Even the strange vicissitudes of white versus white conflicts in state with no possibility of reconstruction didn't appeal to a government losing its spirit for post-abolitionist idealism in the 1870s and 1880s. Reconstruction comes to an end with a certain sense of disappointment. After the end of Reconstruction, the federal government left the entire South to its own devices. So why would Eastern Kentucky be any different? Other so-called feuds that I've seen recorded in Eastern Kentucky also happen alongside more famous violent events around the United States, not all of them related to Reconstruction. For instance, the so-called Rowan County War coincided within just a few months of the Haymarket Affair in Chicago. The most publicized events in the Hatfield-McCoy situation took place just a year or so before the Wounded Knee Massacre, which I've mentioned already. And this isn't to say these events were necessarily connected. However, they do show that there was nothing particularly unique about what was happening in Eastern Kentucky. Mass killing was rampant all over the U.S., especially in the South. And in every case, the ones we know about were typically the result of power struggles. It was only in Eastern Kentucky that violence of this sort seemed to be almost strictly carried out between whites. And for that reason, it did not seem to conform to the race-based definition of politics that so many Americans, the American reading public, hewed to in the 19th century and, of course, in the early 20th century. And this, I believe, is the reason that so many Americans are so easily write these conflicts off as so many so-called feuds. Moreover, the word feud suggests that violence here could not be explained or prevented, and that worse, their fighting had nothing to do with the rest of the United States. Ironically, this has served to make the so-called feuds more palatable and enjoyable in semi-historical form, like, of course, the miniseries we saw about a year ago on the, I used to call it the Hitler Channel, but I think nowadays we got to call it the Pawn Shop Channel, or whatever they're showing on it out these days, I don't know. In Eastern Kentucky, communities are beginning to use these events as a tourist attraction, as we were discussing last night. It's in contrast, it's doubtful that hot spots during Reconstruction in the Deep South, like, say, Edgefield, South Carolina, Bloody Edgefield, they call it in South Carolina, or the Colfax, Louisiana, down the Red River Valley, one of the worst massacres in 1873 during Reconstruction, it's doubtful these communities will ever rise to the occasion and attempt to market their own history of 19th century violence as a tourist attraction. The same probably won't be attempted at Wounded Knee. And then last I checked, the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument is one of the least visited national battlefields. Now, part of that's because of where it is. It's a little bit off the beaten path. Nevertheless, though, it's one of those stories that maybe Americans wanted to contemplate back in the 50s, but not so much now. While this is a boon to Kentucky communities, I hope they do try to include broader issues in the way that they curate and the way that they interpret their own respective so-called feud exhibits. I doubt they'll want to highlight the role of political parties, because imagine the cans of worms that would open. But I do hope that they won't try to suggest that these murders and gunfights took place within some bubble. And I do hope that they do try to research the origins of such rather than allowing the fun possibility of consigning it all to legend rather than history or some other amorphous, ambiguous word. This is a way bigger than one section of one state or one commonwealth, if you prefer. We should always, no matter whether we're talking about Eastern Kentucky or Afghanistan, we should be careful that we never allow violence to go unquestioned. Senseless is a word, or irrational, another word, that suggests that it cannot be prevented by regulation, indeed cannot be prevented at all since it happens so randomly. And I think this is an opportunity, in looking at our own history, our own local-ish history, this is our opportunity to say, actually, violence can be explained, and violence can be explored. We just have to force ourselves to look at it and look at the details. Thank y'all very much. Do we have time for questions?
Yeah.
Good. Yes, either one of y'all. In Washington, D.C.? Oh, man, you're putting me on the spot. He's asking if there is an official monument to the Civil War anywhere in Washington, D.C., and I'm drawing a blank unless you count the Lincoln Memorial. Where is it? I haven't been to D.C. in about, well, the last time I went through it wasn't a sightseeing, but why do you ask that? Boy, and speaking of opening up cans of worms, imagine if they ever tried it. I bet most, whoever serves on those, I think that's why. It would open up a serious historical/political can of worms that I wouldn't want to be anywhere close to. They say, you want to be a consultant, Dr. Hutton? No, thank you. Yes, let's kind of go like that. Yeah. Mass production. Mass production.
Surplus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The repeating rifle, that's the key right there. The repeating rifle, which premieres, I'm not a munitions historian, but I believe the Henry rifle and later the Sharps rifle and the Winchester that we see premiering during the war, I think is, in terms of just the ability to kill quickly and multiple times, I can't take away from that. I mean, that's very important. But munitions is something I can't really comment too much on. Let's see. Okay. Well, someone mentioned that on this side of the room, too. Yeah. And I wonder how many Civil War monuments we have in Eastern Kentucky, for that matter. Yes. Well, now, I'll tell you what. I definitely see what you're saying, and it rings true. But I always tell my students, let's not confuse secession with the war itself. Secession is something that happens state by state between December 1860 and June 1861. But then the war, that's when the fighting starts. And I could probably get all sorts of arguments going by saying this, but the war was not necessarily inevitable after that happened. The war happened because of secession, sure. But, there's all sorts of events that could have led to it not happening. But now, the talk of secession that you hear from time to time in our own time, whether it be Texas or wherever, or even on the county level, it's definitely in reference and in homage to 1860 and 1861. But I reckon the war is over. I grew up in Virginia, I would have noticed. I was one of those kids, I do not remember the first time I heard the name Robert E. Lee. And it was something that was constantly on our minds in the late 20th century. But I think we can more or less put it to rest. On the other hand, there are plenty of historians that say, why do we not look at what goes on? The violence that we see sporadically all over the South well into the 1870s. Why could we not call that an extension of the war? Yeah, a lot of it has to do with which angle you're looking at it from. And the fighting that takes place in the South in the 1870s, it's not a traditional kind of war. The Civil War from 1861 to 1865, it's pretty Napoleonic. It's pretty traditional. But the fighting you see in the mid-1870s, that looks a whole hell of a lot like what we see in Afghanistan and Iraq in our own time. It's 64, 65, sure. Yeah, it did, but I would also say that there's always echoes, but of course the concept of states' rights lived for a good many decades before there was a war. It didn't just get invented in 1860. So you can have discussions about states' rights versus federal power without there being a war to go along with it. Unfortunately, we had the war, though. Now, I told y'all not to ask me about the 21st century, but all right. Well, now, Mr. Deaton knows from my Facebook page that I took a special interest in that whole imbroglio state by state. And I don't think the history repeats itself, but it does rhyme. And I think we can learn about what's going on now by looking at history, but we got to be careful not to confuse the two. There are similarities, there are similes, there are metaphors, but we got to remember historical context. We got to make sure and not exaggerate the lineage between the two. But I think there's a lot to be learned about the present from history. So my answer is yes. You then you.
In your work on Global.com, have you...
I just got started on that, okay. But okay.
Have you come across the Baker Howard feud in Clay County?
I have. In fact, Dr. Dwight Billings up at UK has written a very good book on that. And stay tuned. I'll come back here and talk about that. Yeah, stay tuned. I'll come back and talk about that once I've even gotten started on it yet. Now, folks, you got to understand, I need to do the index for my first book before I can even start thinking about the second one. That's what the holdup on that is. Tony? I'm not sure. Now, that was the question I had. And I want to make clear, I found out about this particular conflict happening at the polls in fall of 1868, very late in the game. That is less than 2 years ago. And I found some congressional hearings that were and a number of affidavits that were taken because of a conflict over the results of a congressional election for that year. And a bunch of people swore to seeing this confrontation take place. First, Wiley Amos is threatening a bunch of people with a club, and then he sees his old friend walk up, and he calls him that damned radical or something to that extent. And boy, I was tickled to find that, because there had been so few connections beforehand that were that clear. But is this necessarily going to apply to many other so-called feud situations? I'm not so sure. What made Breathitt County different in the late 1860s was that there were more African Americans there than there would be 20 years later at the time of the Hatfield-McCoy feud, or at least at the time when it was in its second phase. And of course, that being a situation that was devoid of racial significance. It didn't really have to do with how many black or white Kentuckians have to be in the locale. It had to do with the fact that Wiley Amos was a Kentuckian and a Southerner, and he was not just concerned about Breathitt County, Kentucky. He was concerned about Kentucky, and he was concerned about the United States. And that gets back to my original point. These folks didn't live in a bubble. And if you had just gotten done fighting the largest war in the history of the Western Hemisphere, you were probably more aware of the so-called outside world than you ever had been. And so you wanted me to talk about the 14th Amendment itself. That, of course, hadn't been ratified yet, or maybe it just had been. But, of course, black men voting didn't happen in Kentucky until 2 years later after the ratification of the 15th Amendment. Nevertheless, though, this was something that Wiley Amos shared with a lot of other white Southerners. He's not the one I have a hard time figuring out. Bill Strong, who arms his former slaves, and in fact, someone of biracial heritage, a guy named Hiram Freeman, ends up serving alongside Strong and Amos in the 14th Kentucky Cavalry and then later the Three Forks Battalion. That's the weird part. Why would someone favor it? Because for a white Southerner in Kentucky or anywhere else in the former slave states to try to push this forward, that's the weird part. And it's not common to Mountaineers. It's in some ways, it's very unusual. Yeah. Yes.
Jacob Klein owned slaves, and they were unionists. And the folks who were the Confederate sympathizers, they didn't own any slaves.
That's right.
It's
not always, and it was, I would argue that Breathitt County is a very different place than the Tug River Valley, partly in that respect. But also, Captain Strong was a former slave owner himself, and I don't know what switches off in his head. Or for that matter, there's plenty of non-slaveholders fighting for the Confederacy in the Three Forks region, in Breathitt County and surrounding areas too, just like all the other non-slaveholders who fought for the Confederacy too. So it's not slavery and race don't explain everything, but they're a part of the story that I think makes this a little bit different than what you found. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think I've come to the conclusion the argument over secession or not secession in Kentucky was based on slavery, not abolition, slavery, and the preservation of slavery. The argument was, which was the best way to do that?
That's right.
To secede or not to secede? Well, the not to secede guys won the argument in 1861.
Mm-hmm. And many of them were slave owners.
Events pulled the rug out from under those people, which is why so few of them had a political career.
Yeah.
After the war was over.
And a lot of them have, I guess you would almost call it buyer's remorse after 1865, and they lead to this sort of, one author has called it a neo-Confederate government that lasts from after the war and for on up to the 1880s and 1890s. And I think that Lieutenant Amos represented that trend in Kentucky history in a lot of ways. But how do I try to explain this relatively small number of white mountaineers who decide that they have the same interests as their non-white neighbors? Jerry?
I grew up on Longstreet.
Mm-hmm. And of course, they come back into the public eye in 1878 when Hiram's two sons are shot on the streets of Jackson. Yes?
And what's your opinion on the 14th and 15th Amendment really being dormant until the Supreme Court held that they applied to states, not just federal, and then, of course, the 1964 Voting Rights Act, because those states continued to have state constitutional endorsed segregation.
That's right.
And voting rights and all of these things. And so, really, I wondered, the state's rights people, really, this 14th and 15th Amendment, that's something that happened somewhere else.
In ways it was. It depends on how, we have Reconstruction, but then what happens after Reconstruction? They call it, white Southerners called it redemption, right? Now, redemption does not happen overnight. South Carolina doesn't rewrite their constitution until the 1890s. Neither does Mississippi. Florida rewrites their constitution in the mid-1880s and institutes what we'd eventually call Jim Crow. Kentucky does theirs in 1890-91, but it doesn't have that many Jim Crow elements. Nevertheless, you have that space between Reconstruction and for a lot of the 1880s, where there is a significant amount of black male political participation in the former slave states. That, yes, that doesn't seem like a very long amount of time looking backward, but it's a good half or three quarters of a generation. It's basically a generation, and we shouldn't forget that. Homer Plessy of Plessy v. Ferguson from Louisiana had grown up with higher expectations than his parents had had, and we need to remember that. Redemption does not happen overnight. And in Kentucky, it never quite happens in the same way that we would see it in the Deep South.
The case of Plessy Ferguson was written by Justice Harlan.
That's right. The latter-day Whig, they've called him. And he was always a great dissenter and one of the most important jurists to ever come from Kentucky. Mm-hmm. He was also the lone dissenter in the case involving the Goebbels situation, too. So he was I'd say a lot of people on the court were happy when he retired.
He was the lone dissenter in the case over the day law in 1908.
Ah, yeah, that's right, too.
The day law established segregation and education.
And, of course, the legislator who came up with it was from Breathitt County. They mentioned that at the Breathitt County reunion last year in Frankfort, and I was very interested to hear that. It's good that sort of memory continues and that people don't just try to bury it. I was very pleased to hear that last year. Yes?
Being from Virginia, is there a controversy over Richmond being supposedly with a monument being made the center, the capital of the Confederacy?
There was. I'm not sure. Excuse me. I'm from the other end of the state. And Richmond was a place to go on vacation and to look at the nice monuments and all that. But I never got involved in that. That was strictly within the city council, within the... And are you asking about in the 1890s when the first monuments went up? It was controversial. And the dissenting votes in the city council on the first Lee monument happened to be the last remaining African-American members of the city council who realized that this was basically... even though Robert E. Lee, whoever he was, what this really represented to most white Richmond residents, they believed went against their interests. But it was controversial. Yes?
I could be dead wrong about this, but wasn't there a Harlan also involved in the Supreme Court decision of 1954?
That's Harlan Jr.
Yeah. Same family.
That's right.
Grandson,
but... I get son or grandson, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they were pretty much all Democrats, weren't they? Especially on the West Virginia side over there in Logan and what became Mingo County. That was, till very recent times, that was a Democratic stronghold.
In Pike Valley, in Pike County, they were pretty much Democrats in Pike Valley. Only across the
Pierpont and that bunch.
That was in their interest. Mm-hmm. Whereas the southern part was very much Confederate.
There was more going on other than just slavery when it came to West Virginia, that's for sure.
State papers kept carving out and expanding into the southern counties because they understood the mineral rights, the value of mineral
rights. Different. Go ahead.
Throughout this, I don't understand why, around the turn of the century, Louisville erected a monument to this Confederate soldier, and maybe you could tell us.
I guess someone got the zoning ordinance for it. and someone was able to finance it. I don't know, but it does go back to, I was being facetious, it does go back to the general sense of regret that a lot of white Kentuckians feel after the war, and why they start electing these Confederate generals like McCreary or Buckner or Leslie and so many others. And that's something that we shouldn't try to trace to the war itself, but to the 25 or so years after the war. And yes, you do have people like Thomas Speed, I believe, who lived right here in Louisville, who is trying to make sure that Kentuckians remember we were a Union state. But there's so many other white Kentuckians who are going, perhaps we can create another narrative here. My friend Ann Marshall, who teaches at Mississippi State, who went to Center, and I think she grew up somewhere near Lexington. She's written a very good book on this subject, on how Kentucky created a Confederate identity for itself. And the statue at U of L, I'm glad you asked me about that, just because I mentioned Ann's book. The statue of U of L is specifically mentioned in there, and she tells the whole story. I just didn't memorize it. But it does have to do with memory more than it does actual experience.
Can you spell the last name for Ann?
Oh, yes. Marshall with two L's. Ann Marshall. And I do not remember the name. I do not remember. Thank you. Oh, no, that's a separate book. That's a different book. How Kentucky Became Southern.
No, that's wrong. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something like making up the Confederate.
Something to that, yeah. Both of them, though, very good books, though. We're ready? How much time do we have?
We're really all right on time. If there's a final question for you, I mean, you've done a great job here.
Yeah, I have.
Yes.
Lincoln was a Republican, right?
Yes. Absolutely. That was the well, there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. I'll say this much. The 20th century happened.
Great question. It's not really. The question is, how did the Republican Party abandon? I mean, that's not your specific question. The Republican Party was poverty. It was the party of black rights in the post-Civil War period.
Mm-hmm.
When did all that change? It was changing over a long period of time.
It's an evolution. Mm-hmm.
Southern Democrats began in mass to become disenchanted with the National Party of Truman and social reform, led by people like Strom Thurmond.
But it doesn't happen overnight, though.
No, but then within the mid-60s, when there's this reemergence of the Democratic Party's commitment to civil rights legislation of the mid-60s, that's when Southern Democrats began to abandon Democratic Party, and the Nixon campaign came up with what was called the Southern Strategy.
Yeah.
A means to calculatedly use coded language to appeal to the racist elements of the old Southern Democrats and bring them into the Republican Party. And it worked like a charm. It's only now becoming unraveled.
But there were other benchmarks along the way, too. I would argue some things happened in the 1920s. The Great Depression, of course, attracts a lot of black voters to the Democratic Party. Many, many different things can be looked at. Oh, not anywhere. You'd be surprised, Jerry. It was the beatnest thing. I looked under every rock and stump. Thank you for asking that.